Hello, everyone. This is exciting. The Kuhn, as you can tell by the large altar behind me, and perhaps I'll turn the camera around so you can see the rest of it. The Kuhn is finally open. And this Wednesday, September the 14th, is our first live lecture where I'm going to endeavor to every week on Wednesday have an open Kuhn so we can perform Gongyo, chant, and discuss together the teachings of Buddha. Tonight, I had the luxury of speaking to you, and I wanted to start, first of all, I wanted to do Daimoku Sancho, which is Daimoku three times, to open this talk series and to close every portion of it, only to make sure that our minds are aligned and that you understand what I'm saying, my intent in what I'm saying, because words can be, well, you know. And then hopefully I'll remember at the closing that we do Daimoku Sancho again. So if you will with me, please. Nammyo Horenge Kyo. Nammyo Horenge Kyo. Nammyo Horenge Kyo. Thank you very much. I'm going to start a series, and I have no idea how many videos this is going to take, but I don't want to make extraordinarily long videos. It's just going, I'd rather you had multiple videos that you could chew on, because this is going to be a lot of information. And of course, as always, I invite you in the comments section, ask questions. There's no stupid questions, okay? Buddhism, the practice of Buddhism could largely be said to be an endeavor of study. So study never ends in Buddhism. You're constantly studying, rereading material, reading new material. That's just part of understanding something, is to get more and more familiar with its concepts and its language, and that's what we do. That's the practice of Buddhism. There is the ritual recitation of two chapters of the Lotus Sutra and the chanting. All of that will become clear as to why it happens as we go through these lectures. The most confusing and least talked about teaching of Buddha that I have been able to witness anywhere on the internet or in temples or in groups or anywhere I've been, is people will mention the 3,000 realms in a moment of life. In the Japanese sects of Buddhism, you'll hear a lot from the Nichiren school, which we are part of that lineage, the Japanese words Ichin and Sanzen, which really is the 3,000 realms in a single moment of life. The 3,000 realms was first propounded in the 7th century by Tendai, Chi Yi, he has many names, and kept in usage in the teachings right through to Nichiren's day in the 13th century, where he really emphasized the meaning of that as Ichin and Sanzen. Sanzen again being the 3,000. Ichinen being an interesting word that really boils down to volition. So when you first hear the statement 3,000 realms in a moment of life, you think it's something that you simply experience, which is correct. But the word Ichinen would also add to that the understanding that what you're experiencing is at the behest of your own volitional power. This is critical in understanding. And I'm going to jump a little bit. It's going to seem like I'm going to jump a little bit, but believe me, all these concepts are the same, and you will understand why as we get further into this. I'm going to tackle the first part of this, which Buddha talked about in his first teachings was the 12 Nidana, or some people say Nibbana. This is all because of language changes from Pali, ancient Sanskrit to more. There was an elite language of an elite class. For thousands of years, civilizations pretty much had just a small group relative to the size of the population that was responsible for keeping the authenticity of the language, the grammar, the meaning of things, the higher thoughts that they shared. In other words, their thinking, their philosophy, the things that their society had learned. The peasantry was too busy trying to survive and farming and working really hard all day to live life. But they had many questions like, why does the sun come back every morning, and so on and so forth. And how long, what happens when I die? I mean, we still have these questions, right? So there was always a caste or a class or a specific group, a ministry, depending on Western, Eastern, North, South. There was always a group that was in charge of handing that off to the next generation and so on. In India, in the Indus Valley area, that group were the Brahmins. So it's not simply, people would think Brahma, oh, that's a religious thing. Don't get confused. There's a lot of talk about Brahma as a god that comes from Hinduism. And India, being one of the most populated places on the planet, for one of the longest times on the planet, outside of our beginnings in Africa, India and then China, very populated very early, and civilized themselves very early, long before the West. They had a lot of folklore to deal with. They had a lot of ignorance that they had to communicate the things that they knew in simpler, modified terms. It created stories around them to try to, not unlike the West with fables and so forth, to try to explain concepts of human behavior and how to behave properly as opposed to not properly. The difference is that in thousands of years ago, behaving properly and not properly was about having a good life, being a good man, being a good woman, being a responsible human. I want to make that clear, because when we think of later attempts at religious attempts, if you will, or philosophical attempts to make rules of behavior for people, they're greatly mystified, especially in the West. And rules of behavior really became rules of governance. How do we control large masses of people? How do we make them surveil themselves so we don't have to have a surveillance officer on top of each one of them, and a surveillance officer on top of the surveillance officer, and the surveillance, it goes on and on and on. So there's a difference, a big difference, between rules of behavior from Muslim texts, Jewish Hebrew texts, or Catholic texts, Christianity, whatever the sect. There's a huge difference in the way those texts were set up to govern people, and the idea of governance or self-governance that was predominant for thousands of years in Asia. So, having said that, the Buddha decided not to talk in elite terms. So when you read the Buddha's teachings, they're full of colorful imagery and similes and little stories from the culture around him, stories that some of which he made up, but all dealing with the temperament and the knowledge and the ability of those he was teaching. Because he decided right off the bat, although he was descendant of a king, he was a prince, And he had access and spent a lot of time with the Brahmin society, and actually would spend his whole life redressing the lost meanings of deep philosophical texts from the Brahmins that over the centuries and millennia simply got watered down and diluted by lower caste and accepted folklore and other things. And he said, I'm wiping this clean, and I'm going to wipe it clean by speaking the language of the people. I'm not going to be all high and mighty up here and speak a language that no one understands. I'm going to take this knowledge and I'm going to make it accessible to the lowest caste person. And because if there's a philosophy that's true, and this is what Buddha's guiding, the historical Buddha's guiding principle, if a philosophy is true and accurate, then it should work for everyone and anyone and anything. You shouldn't have to climb a mountain to gain this knowledge. You should be able to just know it, because the truth is, if enlightenment is real, if having complete full understanding of the process of life and how everything comes into being is accessible, then the truth really is, it's already here, it's already in you. I use an analogy for people sometimes when I try to explain behavior and why we practice and what we're trying to do. Very quickly, I'll give you that example. If you can imagine a state, and we can't, we're human beings, we're in a set of conditions and tendencies that prevents us from just being in this knowing all the time. But we have moments of it. Certainly if you're a woman and when you give birth to a child and you first see the child and hold it against you, there's another world going on in your brain that you find. For men, we find these in very deep, well, we call them aha moments, right? Or big revelations that we have. And it's almost as though everything stops. The whole world ends. This is why the Hindus used to use orgasm, sexual orgasm, which has been misinterpreted as what nirvana is. In so many branches of their philosophy, because there's a moment when during sex where you accomplish an orgasm that time doesn't exist. It's just a moment, but for that moment, time doesn't exist, problems don't exist, you and other don't exist. There's just this blissful, and then boom, you're right back into humanity, okay? What happens in that little moment, if you could try to imagine it with me, is that there is absolutely nothing, and I mean nothing, in the universe and outside the universe that you don't understand. Let that sink in for a moment. If you have that depth of understanding about everything, everything and the everything of nothing, then how can you possibly ever feel influenced or emotional or challenged or anything other than wow? And that's it. It's a, you can call it a permanent state of joy. You can call it unshakable, unbreakable happiness. You can call it enlightenment. You can call it awakening. Awakening is an interesting one to me, because from the get-go, what we learned about enlightenment and the verbiage was awakening. In fact, Buddha's name in many of the writings and still to this day is the awakened one. Enlightened, the light came on. Because when you know this, when you tap into this, you can't ever forget it. And it's unshakable. Nothing can disturb knowing everything, understanding everything, because You already know. Nothing shakes you. That's pretty unimaginable. I get it. But if you can sort of keep that little place of what does that look like in your, keep it a little on a shelf as we go through all of this, it'll help make sense of it. And the first relationship I'll give you for it is Einstein. Einstein's theories, well, let's just go for the one equation, which I believe most of the world still doesn't understand the significance of. And I'm sure you've heard it. You've seen it in cartoons. Everybody knows it. E equals mc squared. What does that mean? Big E, energy, equals, not similar to, not sometimes, not when you look the right way, not when energy feels like it. Energy, all energy, any form of energy is exactly identical to, equal to matter. Stop right there. How is energy equal to matter? What? How is this book energy? How does energy become this book or a blade of grass or you and me or universe? Energy equals matter times a constant speed of light squared, which we don't even know what that is. Because anytime we approach the speed of light, we cease to be able to experience what's happening. Notice the way I said that. For decades, what most scientists and mathematicians and teachers and people and things you read would say of E equals mc squared is energy equals matter times the speed of light squared. And then if they talked about the speed of light, they'd say, well, the speed of light, when you approach the speed of light, when you get to the speed of light, you disintegrate. There's just nothing. Nothing can exist beyond the speed of light. That, I hate that statement. Nothing can exist beyond the speed of light. No, you don't know that. Did you go there? No. A mathematician wouldn't say that. A mathematician would say that beyond the speed of light is a territory we're incapable of understanding. Otherwise, how could math just decide to square it? You know 2 times 2 equals 4, right? So 2 squared is 4. And 4 times 4 is 16. So 4 squared is 16. Well, the speed of light is close to 190,000 miles per second. 190,000 squared. That's fast. How can you even propose that in your mathematics if you're then saying nothing exists there? So the truth is, the relationship of matter to energy has a lot to do with its perception of time. Because speed is space divided into increments. Speed is time. And space is time. Because you can't have space without time. From here to there requires space. And time, from here to there, from a now to then or there, requires space. So when you start studying science, you start getting more and more accustomed to the term space-time. And then we talk about how it bends. But this isn't the science discussion. I just wanted you to think that in, for whatever reason, energy in different states of being is either matter or energy. So you have today, just recently I watched a talk where a physicist, a scientist, struggled with the question we asked ourselves as children. Okay, if there's a big bang and the universe was created, What was it created in? There had to be something. If there was a big bang, certainly the bang was in relationship to something, right? Wouldn't you say? Hope we didn't lose picture there. So the idea is that whatever the big bang was, this rapid expansion of what we are made of, occurred within the same stuff that it reacted in. It's just that the environment of the creation of the universe was an area of what some would call a very low energy. The energy is there, but it's very quiescent. And so it took a moment of extreme activity for that energy to start precipitating matter. You know, it makes sense. Stay with me. So, because we're already at 21 minutes here, I'm going to read through this 12-link chain kind of quickly. But since I've got you in the mind set, hopefully, this will give you something to chew on until the next video, okay? So the 12-length chain goes something like this. And this is a book that I put together a number of years ago. You can get it on our website. You can get it on Amazon, I think. I don't know, is there ISBN number? Anyway, I'm going to show you the illustration, not that it answers everything, but it gives you an idea. Okay, what we're going to do is, because we're humans and we see things from top to bottom or left to right or right to left or whatever, we're anal that way. We like things in a line. I'm illustrating the Nidana, and the discussion on the Nidana has always been a top to bottom kind of thing. The Nidana, I'll preface on, 20 minutes hasn't been a preface, Sifu. I'll preface with this. The Chinese have a concept called Wu Ji. And in this concept, Wu Ji is characterized, like caricature or like characters, you know, like kanji or calligraphy. Wuji is characterized as a circle, which is also a point. Very Einsteinish, but long before Einstein. What they were saying is that a point is not a thing. A point is a location. You'll study this in math in school. If you identify a point, like a place on a map, you know the coordinates of it, this far west, this far northeast, and so on and so forth. There's a bunch of numbers that put you to that point. But that point, if you try to see that point, it's not there. It's just a reference point. But if that point is a container, and what it contains is potential. Just the potential for anything and everything. But there's nothing there. It's a point. But from that point, anything and everything can manifest. So a circle representing that point kind of makes sense, as the point is a container. Wuji. It's a state of very low energy, sound familiar, where nothing is manifested, but everything is. But because the word everything implies numerous things, it implies that things already exist, which they don't. It's just energy. One of the key concepts of Buddhism is impermanence. Nothing, no thing exists in and of itself. It simply arises and then dissipates, goes away. just like your thoughts, just like a sneeze, just like this universe. It arises and then it quiesces. Nothing lasts forever. All the cliches, we can go on and on and on and on. Nothing lasts forever. Why? Because no thing exists in and of itself. It is an accumulation of different energies. Everything is an accumulate. Vasubandhu used to call these the five aggregates. But that comes after the conditioned genesis. How in the world do we go from a low energy nothingness, noumena, to phenomena? That's what conditioned genesis, that's what the 12 Vedana, that's what the causal chain is about. And Buddha was teaching this 3,000 years ago. You want to know how birth happens? This is it. You want to know how a tree happens? This is it. You want to know how your own thoughts happen? This is it. How to start a business? This is it. Everything comes through this chain, causal chain. Causal, causal. What does that mean? It means there was some intent. Because nothing happens without intent. Intent tickles our volition. Because the minute we experience, the minute intent exists, it immediately wants to know what it is to exist. Because it doesn't know yet. I intend to. Gosh, I want to know where that intention takes me. Wait, where does it take me? Where am I now? What does this feel like? What will that feel like? Where will this intention take me? What will it look like, feel like, smell like, think like? See, everything precipitates from this immediate, this first instance. And it happens very quickly. As the title of these lectures should remind you, 3,000 realms in each discrete moment of life. Because that's life. All life. All life is wuji, little tiny imperceptible points that come one after another. And if you remember your geometry, one after another, these loci, these points, create what? A line. What you and I would call a timeline, a lifetime. Okay, that's enough for this lecture. I think I've tweaked your brain enough. Please think hard about that. If you can find some literature on the 12 Nidana, go ahead and read it. It won't bother me because we're going to be reading different versions of the same thing. But this is basically what the causal chain is. How an tiniest fraction of thought, idea, can precipitate volition, desire, want to such a degree that we must instantiate. A blade of grass goes through it. A tree goes through it. How did a seed come about? Because the tree wanted to be, and the seed was the vehicle to get to being a tree. How did I come to be? My vehicle was finding the right tendencies and conditions within the belly of a woman and the DNA and the construct of the man and the woman. And I thought, I fit there. My entity said, that's where I'll gestate. I became a fetus. I was born with the help of these two individuals who I'm karmically very closely related to. Because that's how we fit through our energy vibrations, our karma, our causal similarities. That's the 12 Nidana. We can get technical and read through all of them. And maybe I will, but I don't want to spend too much time on being a scientist about this, because you can do the study on your own. I want to make it make sense to you in a simple way. So if I missed something, please comment below. In the meantime, I love you all. Let's do Daimaku Sancho and end this lesson. I thank you so much for listening. If you can, I don't know if you can tell I'm sweating. We don't have air conditioning at the Kwun yet, and it's the middle of September in Mississippi, so it's a little warm. If you can help us out in any way with contributions, check our website, help us out, but it's not required. The reason I'm doing this is to teach as many people as I can these amazing, amazing teachings. You will be joyful. You will be happier. You will love life more. And you'll understand it, which is so cool. No shrink needed. Okay? All right. Here we go. Ready? Namu Myo Ho Renge Kyo Namu Myo Ho Renge Kyo Namu Myo Ho Renge Kyo. Thank you so much. You guys be good. Can't wait till next Wednesday. I got so much more to say. But till then, bye-bye.